Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is writer, journalist, and academic Ellen Ruppel Shell. And we're talking about her new book, Slippery Beast, a true crime natural history with eels. Ellen, welcome to the show. It is such a pleasure to talk to you about this book.
Well, thank you so much for having me, Mark.
This is one of the classic books. I don't get a lot of them, but I do enjoy reading them, where the author goes down the rabbit hole.
That's right.
And I sincerely got the feeling you went way down the rabbit hole, and it went into places that you weren't sure, and you didn't know where it was going to go.
Absolutely. From the very beginning, I didn't know what direction it was going to go.
How did you get to write a book about eels? You're not an ichthyologist.
That is for sure.
But you've written about science a lot, but this is definitely like a major undertaking.
Yeah, this is like a 180-degree turn from my last couple of projects. But I'll tell you, I have to say, I didn't find eels. They found me. And if you like, I can tell you a little story about how that all happened.
Sure.
Okay, well, as you probably know now, I live about half the year in Maine, about an hour or so from Portland, on the coast, about a mile from the ocean. And I'm telling you that because when we bought this place years ago, it needed a lot of work. And about 10 years ago, we hired a guy who I'll call Sam to help us out. You'll see later why.
Okay.
I don't want to share his full name. To help us out with some home repairs. Now, Sam told us he was a wonder with power tools, but if that were ever true, Sam's wonders ceased with us. Lots of days he didn't show up at all, and some days he'd come real late, and some days he'd quit early and come into my kitchen with a four-pack of cider and want to talk, which is not uncommon in Maine.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I kind of like Sam, and I must say that I loved his story, so I would indulge him in this. And we'd sit there drinking cider, and he would tell me stories. And one day he told me about his grandson, who he dearly loved. He was 49 years old, but he had an 8-year-old grandson. And he used to teach his grandson how to play t-ball and how to play horseshoes. He was a champion horseshoe player. And he wanted to teach him how to fish. And he was going to do that once he earned enough money, put together enough money to buy a boat. Well, I asked Sam, listen, it doesn't seem like you're totally into home repair. Maybe you want to mix business and pleasure and get yourself a fishing license to go along with that boat. Become a commercial fisherman, like so many people do in my neck of the woods. And he said, well, yeah, I could do that. In fact, I did do that a while back.
Mm.
But not anymore, not with the eels. And I said, what? What are you talking about? And he says, oh, come on, you know. And I said, no, I don't. Fill me in. And so he goes, well, you know, the eels, the baby eels, you know, they're worth so much money now that fishermen are carrying guns. They're packing guns.
Wow.
And they're getting into fights. And it's gotten really, really dangerous down by the river. I don't want anything to do with those eel wars. Well, so after I had this conversation with Sam, he packed up his stuff, got back in his truck, drove off, and to be honest, I never saw him again.
Wow.
Yeah. So, you know, my husband, I think, well, he probably did buy that boat with the advance payment that we've been dumb enough to give him. But as angry as I was at Sam, I also feel that I have a great debt to him because although most of what he said, or half of what he said, was, you know, I never believed, what he told me about eels turned out to be true. And, you know, I didn't, you know, that led me down this rabbit hole, as you mentioned.
Wow.
Into the, you know, what I think of more as a cabinet of wonders and into the world of eels that I had no idea about. And so that's how I tripped over this.
And this is a really fascinating book because it follows two parallel tracks. The one is the history of the natural history of people trying to figure out eels, which is continuing today. There's just an entire weird and bizarre natural history of eels. There's that going on in your book, and it's really well told. But then there's the Cosa Nostra of eels. And it's not so funny, actually, because people, it's a really dangerous business, and there's a lot of poaching, and there's a lot of illegal taking of eels, and there's a big business and lots of money to be made out of eels. And that's a weird story, too.
Yeah, in fact, I just forgot to mention part of what Sam told me, which was, look, you know, I talked to him. Why are people, you know, getting into fights over eels? What's going on, you know, with baby eels on the river? I mean, we're a state where lobster is king, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And lobster sells for maybe, what, $10, $12 a pound retail, and it's a luxury food. It's a delicacy. It's delicious, right? But who's going to pay real money for a baby eel?
Wow.
And, you know, what Sam told me was, okay, you serious? You think $10 a pound is a lot? Baby eels are going for $2,500 a pound.
I think somebody in the book mentioned that on a moonless night, I love that, a man could catch $40,000 worth of eels.
That is correct. And in Maine, that's real money.
Oh, yeah.
Right? So that's more than some fishermen make in 6 to 10 months. And they can make it in one night. Fishing for eel, baby eels on the rivers.
Well, you know, let's talk about the natural history of the eels. The eels are an interesting fish to begin with because they're not anadromous, they're catanandrous. They have a weird life cycle. Let's talk about it.
Yeah, it's a life cycle that is really puzzled and, I would say, obsessed scientists since Aristotle. I mean, Aristotle had his own theories about eels, and through the years, through the centuries since Aristotle's time, many, many famous scientists have been very interested in what they call the eel question. It's a real mystery, and that life cycle is that mystery. So eels are thought to spawn in the Sargasso Sea, which is itself a really weird place.
Yeah.
I went down there to check it out, and I got to tell you, it's weird. It's the only sea in the world that's bounded by currents, not by land masses. So it isn't even really what we think of as a sea, but it's thought that, it still hasn't been proven, by the way, it's thought that eels spawn there, and their larvae, the little larvae that look like little willow leaves, tiny willow leaves, that result from that spawning, in the case of the Atlantic eels, which are the European and the American eel, they spawn there, and then the American eel takes off and finds its way up the coast of the United States and to the state of Maine, where we have the country's only significant fishery for baby eels. So the life cycle is very strange. When the larva gets to the continental shelf, it changes into something called a glass eel, which basically looks like a bloated toothpick, okay? It's transparent. It's a really weird-looking thing. People didn't even know that it was an eel. They thought it was some other animal until relatively recently. And then as it approaches the rivers, leaving the ocean and approaches the mouths of rivers, it turns again into something called an alver, so it gets some pigment. Then it can't either stays in that salt water or it goes up into the rivers, up into lakes and ponds, and it can sit there for up to 40, 50 years, growing and changing first into a yellow eel and finally into a silver eel, the final stage, at which point it turns around and goes back to the Sargasso Sea to spawn once or maybe twice and die.
Now,
that's a life cycle.
And I want to mention, there's so much more detail in the book and how people discovered this, which is wild. But let's get back to the eel market. So what people are doing is they're catching these eels. Now, yes, the United States, people in the United States used to eat a lot of eel.
Yeah.
And then I think it was after World War I or World War II, they stopped.
Yeah.
But then sushi came.
Yeah.
But they're not eating our eels.
No, they're not. Well, they're not eating. Okay, they are eating our eels, American eels, but the eels are caught as babies, typically in Maine, okay, in the United States, and then they're shipped to China to be grown up in eel ponds in China. There are about 1,000 eel farms in China.
Oh, my God.
So most American eel at this point is grown in China, grown up in China, and then shipped back to the United States. So most of what we eat in the United States was first potentially, you know, an American eel caught as an infant, shipped to China, and then shipped back. Look at that supply chain. Isn't that crazy?
And also, yeah. Eel is huge around the rest of the world. I mean, people eat a lot of eel elsewhere, and not just for sushi, unagi. People eat, like, fried eels. People eat pickled eels. People eat jellied eels.
Yeah.
So there's a big market, and a lot of that, or a sizable percentage, I should say, comes out of the eels that are caught in Maine. And so there's a lot of money to be made.
A lot of money.
International market. And so whenever you have a situation like that, where there's a limited resource in a small place and there's a lot of money, there's going to be trouble.
That's so true, Mark. In fact, the black market in Elvers is the number one, in terms of money, the number one wildlife crime in the world.
Wow.
So we think it's things like elephant tusks or tiger paws or things like that, various body parts, exotic body parts. The biggest wildlife crime in terms of dollars, $4 billion a year, is baby eels.
Wow.
Yeah. And syndicates, cartels, all sorts of nefarious people have been involved in this around the world.
And the amazing thing is you get to talk to some people that are in that business.
I did.
By the way,
very scary business.
Although your book is mostly upbeat, there were times in that book, like when you, I don't want to mention names right now, but it was pretty tense, and I wasn't sure what was going to come out of it. Obviously, you lived, but
yeah.
I was really surprised you just sort of went and did that.
Yeah. Well, believe me, there were points, you know, when I was a little scared and was hoping myself for a bodyguard. You know, some of these people do have bodyguards, and it is a scary business. One gentleman that I spoke with in Europe went to a meeting with someone who was going to tell him the story of eel poaching in another country, and he left that meeting because he was so scared for his own life. And so it is a slippery business, the eel business.
Oh, I can't believe you went there.
Who could resist that?
I know. Now, the weird thing is that there's all sorts of weird names for eels in Maine. It's Maine's white gold, somebody called it.
Yeah.
And but somebody declared Maine a Fort Knox of American eels.
Yeah.
And the problem is many of these eel species, and there's a lot of eel species around the world, but a lot of them are endangered or they have declining populations. So that's another whole element that's part of the problem.
Yes. Well, the European eel and the Japanese eel, which are the two other major commercial eels, when we think of eel, that's what we think of, the American eel, the European eel, and the Japanese eel. Those two other species have declined by over 90% since the 1970s. So they used to constitute about 50% of the biomass in many rivers in both North America and in Europe. But in Europe now, it's down by more than 90%. In Japan, it's also down by more than 90%. In the United States, it's down by 50%. So it's not technically endangered. It's not on the endangered species list in the United States, but many people think it should be.
Wow. Well, part of the problem we have here, first of all, is water quality. But second of all, is all the erection of the dams that have been put on rivers that eels can't return. But there have been people who've been building eel ladders, right?
Yes. I spent some time with people who have been building eel ladders. And, you know, especially around turbines. You know, turbines really chop eels up. You know, they're long fish. And, you know, especially eels, the silver eels going back to spawn, they're typically caught up in those turbines. They're unable to go back to spawn, and you know what that means, no babies, further decline in the population. So it's a tough life being an eel, trust me.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is writer, journalist, and academic Ellen Ruppel Shell, and we're talking about her new book. It's one of those books that has so many interesting digressions in it. I love reading it. We're talking about Slippery Beast, a true crime natural history with eels. Now, I want to talk about some of the things about people trying to figure out eels. Initially, people were just considered that how they bred was spontaneous generation.
Yes, well, they had good reason to believe that. No one had ever seen an eel egg in the wild, and by the way, no one has ever, to this day, seen an eel egg in the wild. No one had ever seen an eel in the open ocean, and to this day, no one has ever spotted an eel in the open ocean. I mean, this is just remarkable, considering the technology we have to see things.
And what a common fish it is.
And it's such a common fish. And so because of that, Aristotle is the first one that I know of who came up with this idea that eels reproduce spontaneously out of the mud. They just came out of the mud. And as we all know, I mean, Aristotle was one of the greatest thinkers of all time. He had a lot of followers.
Up to a point.
He had a lot of followers, and not many people disagree with him. I mean, this was what people thought for a very long time. In fact, the whole theory of spontaneous generation was in part supported by this example of the eel. So this, you know, as I said, this went on for centuries, this idea that the eel would reproduce spontaneously. Some people were uncomfortable with that idea, you know, for various reasons. But it was pretty much sustained. And then there were a bunch of other theories about how each one more crazy than the last, you know, that it would, you know, that eels would just come, you know, out of some kind of foamy substance out of the earth, or just a whole variety, you know, or were produced in Sardinia. The fishermen thought it came out of a certain eel beetle, you know. there was just all these different theories. But why not? Because eels seemed to be everywhere, and no one could, you know, there were no eel eggs that they could find. There was no, they'd never seen an eel spawn anywhere. So how did they reproduce? So any kind of imaginative notion you might have seemed valid, right? That was through history, and that is why this great eel problem, or the mystery of eels, has been of interest to scientists, you know, for centuries.
And painfully, slowly, they've been able to tease out some of the things, for instance, that they go to the Sargasso Sea. That was a huge thing to figure out.
It was. I mean, it started Johannes Schmidt, right? This guy who was this, you know, sort of intrepid dude, right, who was funded by the Carlsberg Beer Company, right, which is great. You know, I've got a chapter that puts him together with this beer company, the Carlsberg Beer Brewery Laboratories, right? So he'd married the daughter of the head of the Carlsberg Brewery, and so he had access to ships and, you know, other, you know, materials that he needed to search. Turns out he devoted his life to the search for the birthplace of the European eel. He spent, you know, oh gosh, you know, over 25 years going on these ocean expeditions. And what he would do is he'd look for eel larvae, you know, those fertilized eggs, those eel larvae that find their way to the European coast and the American coast. In his case, it was the European coast. And he'd look for smaller and smaller larvae. You know, the assumption, it's a good assumption, that the smaller the larvae, the younger the larvae, right? And he would follow them, and he never made it to the Sargasso Sea, not really, but he did that. He traced it, and he was the first one to really come up with a theory that, you know, that they spawn in the Sargasso.
Reading the book, it's just so amazing that people, it's a lot of hard work that people put over hundreds of years trying to figure out the smallest detail about eels. But there's also weird stuff about eels that I never knew that I discovered in your book. For instance, I never knew that eels were on the Bayeux Tapestry.
Yes. Yes.
That's huge.
I know. And they're in the picture of the Last Supper, Leonardo da Vinci's Last Supper. I mean, Leonardo da Vinci was a vegetarian, right? but he put a plate of eels and oranges in a small part of the Last Supper. They are in strange places. They were so ubiquitous. They were on coats of armor. They were everywhere. Many tapestries have eels, not just it, right? So it's just something that was part of everyday life and a very important food. But also, as I mentioned in the book, I mean, ancient Romans had them as pets. They had eels as pets.
Didn't one of them put jewelry on them? I was going to say, somebody dressed their favorite eel up.
They did. They were like, they were pets. They would feed them and pamper them. And it was just a bizarre thing. I mean, the Egyptians worshipped eels, you know.
Yeah, they worshipped everything, though.
Well, that is true. Now, to be fair, you're right.
But I like the fact that King Henry I died of, quote, a surfeit of eels.
That is what is said. We do know that he really loved eels. It's really unclear if he died of eating too many of them, but that is the story, and we're sticking to it.
Now, here's another bizarre fact of many that are in this book. Freud figures in this picture.
Yeah. Well, before Freud became what we know as the father of psychoanalysis, he was really interested in the nervous systems of fish. And most people don't know that. I sure didn't know that before I began this project, right? Did you?
No.
I didn't. So he was studying under this, you know, famous scientist in Vienna, the University of Vienna. And this scientist decided that he was going to help solve this eel question, right? he was going to be the one. He's going to do it. But the famous scientist, it was kind of beneath his dignity to actually do the hard work of actually looking at eels to see, you know, what the deal was going on with eels. So he sent Freud, his student at the age of 20, who's a medical student, to Trieste, to Italy, to a harbor town, to look at eels, to dissect eels, and see if Freud could find the male reproductive organ in eels. The male reproductive organ had not really been found, and the idea was, well, probably eels were hermaphrodites, that they had both male and female sexual organs. They could use them interchangeably. There was no such thing really as a male eel or a female eel. This was the theory. This was Darwin's theory, and his advisor was a pal of Darwin's and really wanted this to be true. So in any case, off goes Freud to Trieste, and he writes letters to his friends, which I was able to find, which were remarkable. They're very, very funny because...
Well, he was a real wise ass.
He was a wise ass, and he was making fun of other scientists.
Oh, yeah.
You're right.
He was really throwing shade at other scientists, like, really badly.
Yeah. He accused other scientists of not even being able to use a microscope. He's a wise ass. He's a 20-year-old wise guy. Really, now, of course, he was a very smart guy, and he knew it.
How weird is it, though, that Freud would work on the most phallic of all fish?
Well, that's the thing, and a lot of people who kind of know this story, and there are a few other authors who've written about it, kind of infer that this is, that this was a phallic thing. It wasn't. It really was this whole Darwin question, right? Although the phallic story is better. I mean, we may want to stick with that.
I understand the cover story, but deep down inside, that seemed to be his, like, you know, talisman.
So he's down there. His one job is to dissect a whole bunch of eels and prove that they didn't have a male sexual organ, right? That's what his...
Don't give away any more information, and we're almost out of time anyways.
Make
people have to read the book.
All right.
But I got to tell you, in the last couple of minutes, you also ate a lot of eels.
I did.
Okay. What was your favorite, besides unagi? Everybody loves unagi.
Yeah.
What was your favorite eel dish?
Well, I'll admit, I went to Paris to talk to some scientists in Paris, and I went to Restaurant Eels, Okay, Restaurant Eel. There's an actual restaurant with a fantastic chef in Paris, the 10th arrondissement in Paris. And he prepared for me his signature eel dish with apples, and it was fantastic. I even took pictures of it. It was wonderful. So I would say that's where I have my favorite eel dish. However, listeners who might be interested might want to try some American eel that has not found its way to China.
Yeah.
Because now we have the first eel farm in the United
and
States,
that's
the first commercial one.
That's
in Maine.
A fascinating story about Sarah Rademacher.
Rademacher.
I tried polder eels when I was in Holland once, and it was awful. But I like this was smoked eel. It was not that great.
Wild eel is hard. Unlike many things, wild eel most of us don't like the taste of. We like domesticated eel, right? Eel's grown on farms. We don't even know it's grown on farms, but that's the kind of eel we prefer.
This is an amazing book. My guest tonight has been writer, journalist, and academic, Ellen Ruppel Shell. And we're talking about her new book, Slippery Beast, A True Crime Natural History with Eels. Ellen, it's been a real pleasure.
Oh, Mark, it's been great. Thanks so much.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.